From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in this morning's Forum program in our opening hour, officials from Ukraine, the United States, the European Union, and Russia have taken the first steps toward a pact aimed at de-escalating tensions between Ukraine and pro-Russian separatists. But separatist leaders have given no indication they will sign the deal and continue to call for the removal of the government in Kiev. We'll look at the latest news from the region and examine what this means. And then at 9:30, Robert Gates will join us, former U.S. Secretary of Defense, is the only secretary to serve under consecutive presidents from opposing parties. His memoir, Duty, has created a stir for its perceived criticism of President Obama's handling of the war in Afghanistan. We'll talk with Robert Gates. That's up next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. On Thursday, an agreement was hammered out in Geneva between officials representing Russia, Ukraine, the European Union, and the United States, including terms allowing for amnesty for anti-Kiev factions, provided they give up weapons and leave government buildings. All sides agreed on monitors from the Organization of Security and Cooperation, but 40,000 Russian troops remain near Ukraine's eastern border, and pro-Russian separatists who seize buildings in the eastern region of Ukraine appear unwilling to go along with the pact and continue to call for the removal of the present Ukraine government, with the separatist faction of Donetsk pushing for a May 11th referendum on sovereignty. Can divisions, tensions, and the ongoing threat of greater violence be solved with diplomacy? On this opening half hour, we want to turn our attention once more to the ongoing crisis in Ukraine. And we go to Ukraine to talk with Andrew Kramer, who's a reporter with the New York Times, who joins us from Donetsk in Ukraine. And Andrew Kramer, good to have you with us on Forum. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, this is still, I believe, under the leadership of Denis Pochilin, the Donetsk People's Republic. So what does it mean that we have this agreement now in light of particularly Foreign Minister Lavrov saying he wants to de-escalate? Does it really mean that there's going to be any kind of de-escalation?
I haven't seen any movement here in eastern Ukraine. All the buildings that were occupied by pro-Russian militants and supporters of the so-called People's Republic of Donetsk remain occupied. There's also no indication that the armed wing of this movement will surrender their weapons. So the agreement really seems to have fallen flat. The Russian government is asking the new government in Kiev to enforce its conditions, saying that the nationalist militias in the West should disarm. There's very little movement here where the focus of the security concern is in Ukraine, which is in eastern Ukraine.
Well, we're also reading, actually, in today's New York Times about covert Russian operations, about so-called green men and mass men who are Russian nationals who seem to be operating in a way that perhaps may be familiar to those historically aware of it, of what went on in Chechnya and what went on in Georgia.
That's right. The Ukrainian government has released a dossier of photographs that claim to show the same men operating in eastern Ukraine and also in other areas where the Russian military has been active in recent years, including Crimea a month ago and Georgia in 2008. Some of these people I recognize. I'd seen, for example, a bearded man in the photograph while I was reporting here in eastern Ukraine. I can't vouch for the earlier photographs purporting to show the same man in Georgia wearing a uniform of the Russian Special Operations Forces.
And what about the concessions at this point to separatists by the Ukrainian leaders? They're talking about allowing for Russian to be an official language and for more power to local councils. At this point, is that having any kind of weight with those in the separatist movement?
The separatist leadership is rejecting everything that the Kiev government is offering. It's difficult to ascertain what the public opinion is now in eastern Ukraine. Surveys have indicated that most people here do not want to join Russia, but do support some form of local autonomy. And whether these measures an offer of federalization and to ensure that Russia would be a second official language, whether that would be sufficient now, I think the key question really is whether it would be sufficient with the pro-Russian separatists and their backers in Russia, and whether this agreement would set the criteria, would meet the criteria that they have for their goals in this situation today. And that's a little bit unclear right now. So That's my assessment on the offers at this point.
Talking to Andrew Kramer, who is a reporter from the New York Times, reporting to us from Ukraine, from Donetsk. One other question before I let you go, Andrew, and that is what came out last week about issued orders supposedly to Jewish citizens in Ukraine to register and declare themselves. At this point, it seems to be still an enigma as to whether this came from actual members of Ukraine separatist movement or whether it came from perhaps Russian operatives.
And that's right. It's not clear where this leaflet came from. It's just one more sign of a deteriorating law and order in eastern Ukraine. Both sides blame the other for distributing these leaflets until there's some functioning government here. I don't think that that there'd be any light shed on that.
Andrew Kramer, we thank you for joining us. Appreciate your being with us. Andrew Kramer, again, a reporter for the New York Times, reporting from Ukraine this morning. Want to go to Manhattan and have Stephen Cohen join us. He's professor emeritus of Russian studies and politics at New York University in Princeton and contributing editor to The Nation, where he wrote a recent piece titled Cold War Again, Who's Responsible? And his books include Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives and The Victim's Return, Survivors of the Gulag After Stalin. Stephen Cohen, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you.
I should mention that we have had a number of experts talking with us about Ukraine, but they don't really seem to resonate to the position that you have, Stephen Cohen. That's why I wanted our listeners to really hear your position, which has to do really with what you perceive as a demonization of Putin. Actually, Kissinger, former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, agrees to some extent, but that Washington has been anti-Putin and Russophobic and really has pushed Russia a great deal on this whole issue.
Thanks. Let me come back later, though, to something that Andrew Kramer said, because I think it goes to the question you're raising. Let's remember where we are or where we may be. According to a front-page New York Times story yesterday, the White House, President Obama, has decided that it's hopeless to pursue relations with Putin, therefore with Russia today, that could have any positive developments. They may try on the margins, but that's no longer American policy. That is, he's abandoned the policy of the last 23 years since the end of the Soviet Union. And according to this story, it doesn't cite its sources, but it's Peter Baker, one of their lead reporters, that's on the front page. The Obama administration is now opting for containment, the containment of Russia. That's the word we use for American policy after World War II until about 1985 or 6. And therefore, that means officially we are in a new Cold War. If that's so, we've entered it officially without any discussion, real discussion, of how we got into this, which would call for a review, surely, of American policy since the end of the last Cold War. And the article in The Nation, my article, Cold War Again, the subtitle is Who is Responsible?, takes the view that almost unanimously in the United States, certainly in the mainstream media, whatever mainstream means, only Russia and specifically Putin are being blamed for this new crisis. And it's a terrible crisis, the worst of the 21st century, surely, in Ukraine, but being blamed for the new Cold War. And this is being done without a national discussion, a review, not only of who caused the current crisis in the Ukraine, but if American policy over the last 23 years led to it. Now, there's a small group of us in the United States who believe that the United States has been even more responsible than Russia in producing this fateful turning point, if that's what it is, that by moving a Western power led by the United States ever closer to Russia's borders over the last 23 years, spearheaded by the expansion of NATO, a military alliance, which is now on Russia's borders in the Baltic, but not only military power, political and economic, that this was as close to inevitable, this outcome, this crisis, this new Cold War, as anything is, because there were prior episodes when we, the United States, crossed what were Putin's, Russia's declared red lines. In 2008, and I'll end with this, we crossed the red line in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia by establishing a military outpost there, and that led to events, some of them still murky, but to a short war. But the preeminent red line of Russia was, of course, Ukraine, bound to Russia by 300 years of relations, including something that's overlooked, what we might call conjugal relations. There are tens of millions of mixed marriages between Ukrainians and Russians, so much so that many people who live in the territorial borders of Ukraine are hard put to say whether they're Russian or Ukrainian. And that's true of these people who live in Russia, too. So who provoked this crisis is not only important to ask for historical reasons, who's responsible, but if you don't know how you got into a crisis, you don't know how to get out. And I think that's where we are now.
And you have said that this is the biggest fear of war, you believe, with Russia since the Cuban Missile Crisis and the most strain we've had since the Cold War military intervention for Putin's still being an option here. And I understand your position. I mean, not only the NATO Eastern expansion, but the missile defense installations, more NGOs sent to Russia than those coming here. I mean, you make your points very well. Plus, going back to the bombing of Serbia and the detaching of Kosovo. However, let me just for a moment give you the other side of this. The other side of this is that, and I think, as I say, you make a number of salient points here, but that we keep coming back and hearing about Putin's statement that this is the biggest tragedy of the 20th century, meaning a greater tragedy, the breakup of the USSR, a greater tragedy than hundreds of millions of lives lost of Russians in World War II. And a lot of Russian nationalism is behind this. Putin has an 80% popularity rating in Russia.
Everything you say is correct, but you'll forgive me if I become a didactic professor for a minute.
I am one, too, so it's perfectly
all right. So this famous statement that Putin made, translated and circulated here, that the end of the Soviet Union was the greatest tragedy of the 20th century, offended many people. It offended, for example, many Jews who would say greater than the Holocaust. It would offend people who, Europeans who died in World War II. It would offend people who remember Hitler's legacy. It might offend people who believe that World War I was the greatest catastrophe because it led to so much else. So I took this quote, because my Russian is okay, but I'm not a translator, and I sent it to the three best American translators from Russian into English, whom I know. And they all agree that that's not what Putin said. And it hangs on the use of the word great. And Russia has a lot of ways of saying great, greatest, most great. And what the best translation would be, that the end of the Soviet Union was one of the greatest tragedies of the 20th century. Now, how big a difference that would make to Americans who are very happy about the end of the Soviet Union is another question.
This reminds me of We Will Bury You. I mean, it was the same kind of ambiguity in translation.
Let me quote to you something that Putin said. It wasn't original with Putin, but I think it captures what he believes, but also what tens of millions, according to survey polls, of Russians believe. And here's what Putin said. This I got right. I mean, this translation is about right. Anyone who does not regret the end of the Soviet Union has no heart. Anyone who thinks the Soviet Union can be rebuilt has no head. In other words, this is a sentiment in Russians who grew up during the Soviet era. When they were born, they went to school, they fell in love, they made careers, they got married, they had children, they went to summer camp, they joined alumni associations, they did all the things you and I did in America, only they did it in the Soviet Union. And they have memories of that, and that's the regret. But it's folly, says Putin, addressing people in Russia who think it is possible to believe that you can rebuild the Soviet Union. Therefore, I don't give a good deal of credence, though I understand it has to be thought about, that somehow the crisis we're witnessing today is because Putin wants to reconstruct the Soviet Union.
No, but he may want Ukraine as a prize here, certainly the region of Ukraine.
I wouldn't use the word prize. Now we go to something different. Does Russia, like most great powers and even small powers, have a right, how should we formulate this, to national security interests and therefore assurances, especially on its own borders? If the answer is no, Russia doesn't have that right, then it's unique in the history of great powers, because we certainly claim that right, the United States. Then the question, if the answer is yes, where does Ukraine fit in here? And this brings us back to NATO expansion. If the Kremlin believed that the real point of this Western intervention in Ukraine, which we've presented as benign back in November, was merely to offer them the economic prosperity and democracy of Western Europe, then we would ask Putin, well, what has that got to do with your national security? But if the real purpose was to expand NATO to Ukraine, as I personally believe it was, then Putin's reaction, even if we don't like it, was predictable, and it was reckless to provoke that reaction because look where it's led us. Now, you might say, well, okay, this is a murky question. And I would say, yeah, but then I would say let's have a national debate about it here in the United States like we do when we're on our way to war. Even though we went to war in Iraq not so long ago, we had a prolonged debate on broadcasts such as yours and in the newspapers. We're not having that today. There's really, you know that my view, and you know there are a few people who think as I do, but basically it's one hand clapping in this country, and we're clapping toward war.
On that note, I want to invite listeners to join us. We only have a few minutes left, so if you have something you'd like to bring to the conversation or a question you'd like to ask, Professor Cohen, Stephen Cohen with us, Professor Emeritus of Russian Studies and Politics on the line, you can join us now. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. We're going to be talking with former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates after the half-hour break, but you can join us now if you have something you'd like to ask or say about Ukraine. Again, the toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Stephen Cohen, again, is contributing editor to The Nation. He wrote a recent piece, which we will post on our website. It's on there now, in fact, called Cold War Again, Who's Responsible? And his books include Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives and The Victims Return, Survivors of the Gulag After Stalin. Let's, before we go to your calls and emails, I want to hear a quick cut here. This is Ukraine Prime Minister Yatsenyuk on Meet the Press yesterday.
President Putin has a dream to restore the Soviet Union. And every day he goes further and further, and God knows where is the final destination.
Well, there is the, I suppose, point of view that we're hearing not only out of Ukraine leadership, but also to a great extent out of Washington. Let me go to your calls, and let's not tarry here. Arthur, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. Back in the 1850s, the United States bought a big piece of land from Russia called from Mexico under threat of war, the Gadsden Purchase. Ukraine needs money. Why doesn't Russia simply buy Crimea from Ukraine in order to make it all even, and Ukraine could get some billions of dollars, which it desperately needs?
Well, there's already been an annexation, Stephen Cohen.
Train's left the station. There's a joke circulating in Russia that Russia ought to re-annex Alaska. It's a joke, of course, but they have a play on words here. The Russian word for Crimea is Krem. So they're referring to Alaska as ice cream. You can hear the in other words, we should take Alaska back because it's our ice cream, our ice Crimea. But there's a serious point here, which your caller alludes to indirectly. Remember that in November of last year, when this crisis began, when protesters formed in the streets of Kiev, not in the east. The east is our current focus, but all this began in Kiev and West Ukraine, the pro-European parts. Putin said to the European Union, why are you forcing Ukraine to choose between east and west? We are prepared to join you in saving Ukraine financially from the disaster that it faces. And the European Union and Washington said, no, it's an either-or choice. Now the West is faced with a bill in Ukraine. I mean, Ukraine needs $30-40 billion. It isn't going to get it from the West. It can't. Russia continues to say that if these negotiations begun in Geneva last week work out, we will contribute, as indeed Russia did in February and March when they gave Ukraine $15 billion loan and a big discount on gas, because that's worth about $2 or $3 billion a month.
Yeah, but forgive me, Stephen Cohen, there was a $27 billion aid package that was sent by the EU and the IMF to Ukraine as well.
Well, I mean, I don't know if you want to go into this, but if you deconstruct it, all this is, at least thus far, excuse me, it's allergy season. If you deconstruct it, this is just telling banks that might loan to Ukraine, we will back those loans, but Ukraine has to repay them. And the problem in Ukraine is its sovereign debt is so great, it's about to default. The other question is this, and here's something to watch. Ukraine owes Russia at the moment almost $3 billion for energy delivered since February. Russia wants its $3 billion or else. Or else means it won't ship the gas, which means Europe won't get its gas. The question is, will this Western money that's supposed to go to Ukraine, it hasn't gotten there yet, unless Vice President Biden, who has just arrived in Ukraine, has it with him, whether Russia will be paid out of that money. And it appears it will not. So you may face another crisis next week if Russia turns off the gas to Ukraine, which is meant for Western Europe.
Oh, boy. Let me get another caller on here while we have a few moments. Alex, that's you. Welcome. You're on.
Hi. I have a question to the guest. Being a Ukrainian, I just want to ask him what, in his own opinion, America should do, United States, to rectify the situation right now. I understand he believes it was a mistake, you know, to expand NATO to Poland and, you know, to the former Soviet republics. But now that we are here and this is the situation, what do you think the proper course of action for European Union and the United States?
Yeah, see,
thank you.
I think it was adumbrated, hinted at last week in Geneva when Russia, Ukraine, the European Union, and the United States met in Geneva. And if you look at the accord, they're saying that the violence must stop. The problem here is neither the Russians nor Kiev can stop the violence in eastern or western Ukraine because it exists in western Ukraine. But the key thing from the Russian point of view is this. A declaration that NATO expansion to the former Soviet territories is over. That would include Ukraine. New elections in Ukraine, not just for the president, but for parliament. A new constitution that's federal. That is, all the regions would have more autonomy. Now, therein lies the rub. The United States fought a civil war to figure out how to have federalism in the United States. It is a devilishly hard form of national unity, but it can be done. There's a way if there's a will. The problem is the Russians are asking for too much confederation. That is, they want the regions in the east to have more autonomy than would sustain a unitary Ukrainian state. But this is negotiable. So this is where you begin. You stop the violence, you stop NATO expansion, and Ukraine becomes a neutral. Some people have referred to the status of Finland during the last Cold War. I'm not sure that's the right analogy, but we get the point. And then Ukraine retains its territorial integrity through a different kind of constitution. For example, at the moment, all the Ukrainian governors of the regions are appointed by Kiev. Moscow is saying they should be elected. Well, we elect our governors in the United States. Is that such a heretical idea?
Well, we'll let it stand there. Stephen Cohen, good to have you with us. Appreciate your being with us. And again, you can read Stephen Cohen's article online, kqed.org/forum. He is contributing editor to The Nation and professor emeritus of Russian Studies and Politics at NYU and Princeton. When we return, we're going to talk to former Defense Secretary Robert Gates, who served in both the Obama and the George W. Bush administrations, and we'll hear his thoughts about Ukraine as well. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny.